Hi, I'm James McElvilly, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. So today we're talking to Anna Bischbitzka here in Canberra and asking her about her very influential life and work in semantics. To get started, could you tell us about how it all started? Like, how did you get into semantics?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was born and educated in Warsaw. I studied at Warsaw University. What I studied at the university was mainly Polish literature, Polish studies. And I was very enthusiastic about it. And when I finished, I got an offer of a job from the Institute of Literary Research of the Polish Academy of Sciences, and I did my PhD there, which was on the 16th century Polish Renaissance prose. It was all of great interest to me, and there was a book which came out of it. But after I finished my PhD, my PhD supervisor at the academy sent me to Moscow for 6 months. And that was extremely influential for me, because I landed in the middle of, extremely interesting group of people, linguists, but they were also dissidents, and they became very close friends. And the key people, a couple of key people in this group, Igor Milchuk and Igor Apresyan, were working on semantics, and Alex Zhukovsky. So I got very interested in their work, and in fact, I got even involved in it. They offered me a little project to work on, which was on a part of the bigger project that they were working on. And that was 64 and 65. So I came in the middle of it. I came to Warsaw, and there I heard a lecture at the Warsaw University on semantics, which really sort of changed my life, and it gave direction to my life. I was already interested in semantics through the work of my Russian friends. But Andrzej Boguslawski, who was a lecturer in Russian at Warsaw University, gave this fundamental lecture, a lecture entitled On Foundations of Semantics, in which he reminded people of Leibniz's. I can't even remember whether he mentioned the name of Leibniz or not, but the idea was Leibniz's, that there must be some fundamental elementary human concepts found in the different languages on which all human thinking is based, and that's what linguists should study. So that made a colossal impression on me. And I went back to Moscow for a few months, and I continued with my little project with Milchuk and Apresyan. But I was already completely hooked on that project of Boguslawski. And then Professor Mayanova, who was my PhD supervisor, but also my boss at the institute, decided to send me to America, and somehow managed to miraculously obtain a grant for me to study for a year at the MIT. And that was also very important. Well, MIT was not interested. I listened to lectures by Chomsky and his closer people who worked with him, including Ross and Lakoff, who were to some extent into semantics, but mainly it was all Chomsky and linguistics. And it was very important to me because over that year, I really understood that that's not what I wanted to do, and I was against it. And I really understood, got even more committed to my semantic project, which originated from that idea by Boguslawski. And I started writing papers on semantics there. Everybody was writing papers. They were duplicated and distributed and so on. But in any case, I didn't really had very good semantic contact with people there, although I tried, with Ross, with Lakoff, with Ray Jackendoff. But essentially, I was sort of hardened, so to speak, in my own idea that that's what I really wanted to do with my life. So, and then on my way back from America to Poland, I got a little grant for studying linguistic philosophy at Oxford, which was of great interest to me. I saw it as related to linguistic semantics, and that's where I met John. And he went later on to Yugoslavia, where he worked as a translator from Serbia into English, and I returned to Poland, but we maintained in touch, in correspondence, and well, it was a complicated story of Cold War. The contact was very difficult, but in the end we got married and we lived together in Warsaw for 2 years. And Mary, whom you met, was born. And then John decided that he really wants to go back to Australia. And there really wasn't much that opportunity for him to work in things which interested him in Poland. So we came to Australia at Christmas 1972, where John was offered a PhD scholarship at the ANU. So we came with Mary, and well, from the beginning of 1973, I started to look at the situation in Australia, and I applied for a position at the ANU. There was a position which in linguistics, and I got it. So I started teaching at the ANU I think in June 1973, and I've been there ever since. And it was a totally different environment, extremely for me valuable for many reasons. But one reason was that there were all these people around me working on lots of languages of the world. Whereas in Poland, in Warsaw, I didn't have such an environment. Also, I did try to teach, well, learn a little bit of Japanese, and because, you know, semantic universals, universals of human thought, I realized that I needed to find out something about some languages other than Polish and Russian and a few other European languages which I had in contact with. So I started to teach myself a bit of Japanese, well, learn from other people Japanese and a bit of Swahili and this or that, but that was all really minimal. And here, there were all these people who were seriously studying lots of languages of the world, especially people studying Australian languages at the ANU, but there were also many others. So pretty soon, a group of people developed who were interested in joining me in that search for universals of human thought through languages, especially Cliff Goddard, who was my student at the ANU, undergraduate student, and at first he was very opposed to the semantic theory, but then somehow he changed his mind and he became a partner, really, intellectual partner for life. So the work which was developed in tandem with Cliff, and the theory of natural semantic metalanguage was really developed by both of us. And then gradually a whole group of people joined us, and that was extremely important because people who started studying, seriously studying many different languages from different language groups from the same point of view.
Can I ask a little bit about your time in Moscow? So what kind of semantics were they doing there is my first question. And the second is, you mentioned that a lot of them were dissidents.
Yes.
What form did
absolutely,
the tank? Yeah.
Well, Igor Milchuk is well known in linguistics, and his life is a program in semantics is actually the same. He devoted his life to that program, the meaning text semantics. He had very deep semantic intuitions, but he was also very much into technology and into machine translation. And he combined a sort of study of the natural language, natural languages. He knows lots of languages, he's in many different families. It was very deep semantics in the sense that I could see that this was genuine. But I wasn't really interested in machine translations aspect of it, and in the compromises between the study of natural language and the what was practical, technologically practical. And the other person who was key person there was Aprisian. So Aprisian was gradually, he worked with Milchuk, but gradually his word life project became clear to him, which was really in-depth semantic study of the Russian language. And he got again, a large team of people. Nobody at that time was Well, studying serious semantics of Russian, I don't know how to say, there was a very long and rich tradition of Russian philology and the study of the Russian language, absolutely. But sort of systematic study of the kind that Apresyan and his team became involved in was really something new. And he's continued this to he died a year or two ago, but his colleagues were doing very serious semantics, wonderful semantics of Russian. Essentially, that's what they devoted their lives to. And they produced a series of dictionaries. So the idea was not just doing sort of theoretical studies of Russian semantics, but creating active, what they called active dictionaries, which, where people could really understand the semantics of Russian at a very deep level. I don't think there is anything like it anywhere else in the world.
So it was mainly lexical semantics, is that right?
Yes, mainly lexical semantics, lexical semantics, yeah.
Okay. And what about the descent?
Well, you know, that's a big story. They were very uncompromising people. They said what they thought. Egon Milchuk, finally, he emigrated to Canada, I think, in 1966, because he wrote open a letter in support of Sakharov. And police started coming to his house, and he became a haunted man. So finally, he was really forced to leave. And Apresyan also expressed dissent. He publicly stood up at a meeting and in defense of truth and in defense of his colleagues, and he was expelled from the institute. So for many years, for 8 or 10 years, he had to work in some kind of, he got a job in some kind of technological institute. He was not allowed to do any work. Well, they were sort of heroes of the time. And there's a book published about them and the whole milieu.
And when you were at MIT, so that's sort of the period when generative semantics burst out,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
So, but you still felt like there was no place for the kind of semantics you were doing in that environment.
No, I was trying very hard to get into contact with intellectually with Rob Hedros and George Lakoff, and at first, they were quite negative. And then one day, suddenly, in a lecture, they declared that they have a new insight, which is that there is a really deep, what do they call it, deep structure, which went much deeper than anything before. And I said to them, well, look, well, that's what I've been telling you for months now. But they didn't really want to talk to me.
Okay. But I guess in generative semantics, the deep structure was linked up to syntax, wasn't it? Like it wasn't purely lexical semantics.
Well, but my semantics wasn't purely lexical semantics either, because what I wanted to understand and what I still want to understand is what people say. And people that don't speak in words, people speak in sentences. So you have to understand the sentence. And therefore, you have to paraphrase to understand the sentence as I see it. And I think that was generally always the understanding. You have to understand also the meaning of the sentence. And for this, you can't ignore syntax. You have to look at them together.
Do you think the fundamental units of meaning are concepts? Is that accurate?
Well, the question is loaded with assumptions. What do you mean by meaning? And
let me phrase it a different way. Could you tell me what meaning is from your perspective?
Well, when people say something, they mean something. They want to say something. Speaking of, even the word mean is problematic because it depends on what you mean by mean. But there are certain, so in order to communicate at all and to understand each other, we have to have some concepts, I have to use the word concepts here. Maybe words, which are self-explanatory. That's essentially what Leibniz was saying. If there is nothing self-explanatory, you can't explain everything because you will never stop anywhere. So there are certain things which are self-explanatory, and you have to rely on those. So, for example, I prefer the words to want and to say to the words to mean, because all languages according to our investigations, do have words for want and for same, but not for mean. But these words only make sense if you put them together in some way. So I want you to know, so I want to say something to you, and I want you to know what I want to say, essentially. So that's the closest I come to meaning. Because in trying to explain it to you, really little sentences, such as, I want to say this, I want you to know it, for example. So these are really bits of meaning, not words as such, although words are essential here. Mm. Know, want, say, well, these are the, but they have to, I, you. So what I believe we have found is really universal, what occurs in all languages, is, first of all, words or word-like units for know, for say, for want, for I. But also they have to be put together in certain ways to make sense, such as I want to say this. That's what I'm doing now, telling you what I want to say, right? And you can't go any further. If you ask me, what do you mean by I want to say? I can't tell you, because that's the limit of what human beings can say, I think.
Yeah, okay. But what does it mean to be self-explanatory? Just that everyone knows it?
Yes. I think human beings are born with certain meanings, which you could observe, I think, with very young children. I have studied it again when my grandchildren were born, you know, how meanings develop. And you can see, well, how the child, for example, starts by saying no or pushing even with a gesture. And you can't explain what do they mean by no. Well, to some extent, you can later say that what the child says when they say no, you know, what the child wants to say is to, I don't want this. And you can tell me, and what do they mean by I don't want this? And I would say, I can't say that, we can't go any further. Do you understand what I don't want this means or not? Well, I think you probably do. And in that sense, it is self-explanatory. But if you tell me that you don't understand, I couldn't explain it any further. And I think, I really think we are born with this. Well, born not in the sense that a newborn baby has these sentences already made, but there is a potential for these sentences and for these meanings, and they appear come very quickly in very young children, such as I don't want this, or also I want this. Yeah. And also meanings like good and bad. You can clearly see how they emerge in very young children in sentences, not just, I mean, a child will not say I, also they may you use their name. And for example, how quickly I was amazed if I thought emerged in their thinking, if I do this, I will do that. So the kitchen was blocked and they were trying to get into it, and they would use some chair or something, and if I do this, then I can do this. And this meaning, I want to do this and I can do it if this happens, these meanings were developing or emerging there in front of my eyes, as, you know, first in their thinking and then in their communication.
But could it be said that meaning is interactional, like that a meaning arises in a specific context of interaction, like that it has to be interpreted into what is said by the interlocutors? Or if you're reading, you know, that if you're reading a text, the reader has to, you know, read into the text of
Tim. Why are you talking about readers and reading? I mean, it develops first long before any reading is there, right?
Yeah, sure. But okay, but if we just go to conversation, would you say that meaning is like formulated in someone's head and then transmitted to a receiver, or that it is read into a particular thing that is said in a certain situation in a pragmatic sort of way?
Well, I really don't know what this would mean. Really, you know, if you, these sentences, I want to do this. Well, what do you want to say about it? You have to state this somehow. And whether you call it pragmatic or something else, well, doesn't really matter. I don't think these terms like pragmatic really help us, or even semantic, help us very much. Ultimately, it comes to a paraphrase. Everything you say can be understood if you paraphrase it in simpler words, down to those words and phrases which are self-explanatory, which are the limit of our thinking and our communication.
But is there always one meaning in what is said? Is it not possible that there can be many meanings that can be interpreted into something that is said? A sort of everyday example of a child saying, you know, I want this, is fairly unambiguous. But there's ambiguity in language, but there's also sometimes deliberate ambiguity, maybe, or even multiple layers of meaning. If you think about things like parables, you know, they might have a literal meaning and then a sort of deeper meaning that has to be interpreted.
Parables. Are you talking about Jesus's parables? I mean, that's something I've worked on.
That's why the example.
Well, I can tell you what I don't know about my current project, which is I'm working on the Jesus's short sayings, and they have been translated into thousands of languages, and of course they have reached billions of people and so on. And I think it's pretty important from a humanities point of view to understand what this very influential man wanted to say. So, for example, what I'm working on now is, he said, don't be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Well, you know, did he mean it on many levels? I actually believe it's a very interesting question. It seems to me that he really wanted people to say what he wanted to say. He wanted to say something with the sentence, and actually I think many people did understand him, although many of the things that he said were misunderstood later on. But this idea, completely new idea, that people can kill your body, don't be afraid of those who kill your body but cannot kill yourself, I think that he knew what he meant. Even though, what words did he have at his disposal? Well, kill, don't, not what, body. These are wonderful words which occur in all languages, including till, I think, which of course can have other meanings in other uses. But in a particular sentence, I think it can be used to convey just one meaning. And the body. And so the question of soul, he wanted to say that people, that they can't kill the soul. And that was very important to him. But was there a word for soul in the language he used which people could understand? And actually, I think that, well, he was a native speaker of Aramaic and of Hebrew, and the words, there is a word translated as soul. If you have ever read the Psalms, which is one of the greatest works of human literature, history, the word soul, translated into English, soul occurs many times on every page. I know that the Hebrew word was nefesh. And so in a sense, Jesus was speaking to people who were native speakers of Aramaic and quasi-native speakers of Hebrew. We became Hebrew. But I think he changed the meaning of the word soul, part of it. He kept core of it. But how do you know? How did they know what he meant when he said they can't kill your soul? Well, in the Psalms, in the Hebrew Bible, people were constantly afraid of their nefesh being killed. So the nefesh, the soul, the Hebrew soul, could be killed. And Jesus was saying people can't kill your soul. So by saying this, he was already changing the meaning of the word soul. And now, how can this sentence be translated into all the languages, well, the thousands of languages of the world? Well, in a sense, it can, it seems to me, not entirely, but to some extent, because it seems to me that every language appears to have, of course, the word for body and for kill and for want and so on. But something like soul, not exactly. Well, I was talking to I asked David Nash to send me the Walbridge translation of the sentence into Walbridge, and in Walbridge the word is pilirpan, which is glossed in the dictionary as soul / spirit. And it's not exactly the same thing as the English soul or as the nefesh, but there are certain core components which we can identify in primes, which are what is especially my soul, because that's the phrase which occurs all the time in the Psalms, and also which occurs in Jesus' speech and in the New Testament. What is my soul? My soul is, I think, something in me. People can't see it. And at least these two components, it seems to me, are also part of the meaning of Pirlirpa and of the meaning of the word glossed as soul or spirit in every other language that the colleagues and I have looked at. So it seems to me that's as far as you can go. Maybe. So maybe when Jesus was saying, don't be afraid of those who kill the body but can't kill the soul, he was at least relying on the meaning of the word for soul in the sense of something in you. Well, think like this. And then afraid. Don't be afraid. Is afraid a universal human word? Of course not. There are many languages. Well, you know, theories of Paul Ekman and other psychologists that fear is a universal human emotion and so on. And this is all very crude. But the essence of meaning here is that something bad can happen, and I don't want it to happen. And I feel something when I think about it, essentially. And these are all universal concepts. And you can't explain it anymore, it seems to me. So what Jesus was saying with this, was, don't think like this. People can kill my body. I don't want this. To think like this. People can't kill my soul.
And you think that that is what Jesus meant, and any other interpretation that differs from that is incorrect?
I don't know. Not
or let me, maybe not in such absolute terms, but that there was one thing that Jesus meant, and that's, we can discover.
Well, that's a very good question, but I think so. There was something that he was trying to say. This was a very important thing, and that's what he was trying to say. I think so.
Okay. Oh, well. That's great. And I guess one other thing I wanted to ask you about is a recent development in natural semantic metalanguage is minimal English.
Yes.
Yeah. So could you briefly describe what minimal English is and what value it might have?
Yeah, well, minimal English is a kind of tool. It's a very reduced form of English, which is tailored to a particular purpose. So it essentially relies above all on shared human concepts. But in certain areas, if you want to make sense to people, you have to introduce some other words, which are so important to this area that you can't really do without them. I mean, it would be very impractical. So, for example, maybe I should. People have they have applied minimal English to many different areas. Well, I've worked with a number of areas, but mainly with Christianity. But I also had those messages during COVID, which I wanted to be translatable, and they were translated into many languages. So certain words were introduced there, which about how to live and how to think and what to do during COVID, in order to, well, cope with the situation. And they were translated into many languages, a number of languages, including by some people in Central Australia. And various compromises were made. So some words were introduced which are not universal, but which were useful for that particular purpose. And I do the same thing with my work on Christianity. When I, for example, I published very recently a book on Nicene Creed, if you know what it was, what it is, main document, which states the shared faith of all Christians, or 99% of Christians, okay, and trying to rely as far as possible on self-explanatory, what I believe to be self-explanatory and universal concepts. But there are certain words which are really very useful, and such as cross, for example, and also soldiers, you know, and nails. For example, Jesus was nailed to the cross. Okay, well, I could explicate these words, but if I explicate nails or cross, especially nails, separately, I mean, I can't do it at one go. People would get lost. So it's useful for me to say that I do explain what cross was in the book. But I think I use words like wood, tool, loam, parts. Okay, so his hands were nailed. I mean, so I introduce these words like nailed, for example, for practical purposes, and that's part of minimal English, even though they are not universal.
But why would people get lost if the meanings are universal? Or why do words exist that bundle up universal meanings?
Well, look, it would take forever. If I tried to talk to you now using exclusively universal human concepts, I wouldn't get far in 1 hour. So obviously, for economy reasons, we do need to bundle up meanings into larger units.
Okay. Just to save time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, maybe not just, but that's one very good reason. I think it's probably more than just time, the question of mental energy. We have these concepts which are complex concepts, which are ready-made, which maybe we think in terms of those ready-made concepts. But at some level, I could disentangle them into primes when I put time and energy into it. But it's a total, colossal sort of time-saving and energy-saving device.
Yeah, okay. And why do you think there are different languages if there are universal concepts? Like, if there are universal concepts, how come we don't all speak in the same way?
Well, look, because there are different cultures, right? And people have different ways of life and different cultures, and there are lots of very important Polish concepts which don't have equivalents in English and vice versa and so on. So languages, as you know, there's a huge diversity of language, but of languages, but they, at some level, they also depend on the shared core, I believe.
Okay. So in principle, you could decompose a culturally specific concept into universals.
Absolutely,
and make
it understandable. That's what I've been doing for years. That's what I've been doing all my life, among other things.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else we should talk about?
Well, I mean, the important thing is that there's the NSM research community. There are lots of people in the world working on different languages and on different areas of human thought and culture and communication using this approach. So that's a huge thing. So it's not just me, and it's not me and Cliff. But there are many, many people working on many different languages, like Felix Amica working on African languages, and Carsten Levison working on the languages of Oceania, and especially on Bislama, has a wonderful new book on postcolonial semantics. I think that's what. And there's Helen Bromhead, who published a book on history of English thinking and the language and culture, and another on the languages of an environment in different languages, and Anna Gładkowa, who published a book on the ways of thinking and in Russian, and Jock Wong on Singapore English. I can only give sort of examples, you know. So it seems to me that this approach, that's one thing. But there is also the question of applications of this to other areas. It's not just about linguistics, and not even just about linguistics and cultural anthropology, but about applications of this in other areas. Well, Cliff and I have just published a paper on art and religion, in which we argue that these words, art and religion, of course, have been studied to death by anthropologists, but always explained in complex words, which English specific. So there's huge Anglo-centrism. Whereas we're trying to have a new look at the concepts of art and religion through, not through English, but through universal human concepts. And right now, for example, I've written a paper intended for medicals, for a journal called Mental Health and Well-Being, which has to do with our current situation here and my place where I am. on mental health and mental and carers and mental health professionals. What sort of training should they get in order to be able to communicate with people? So these are very practical areas, and I think you can reach communication with and some kind of understanding with anybody through shared concepts, not through fancy high-level intellectual English, with all my respect for it and reliance on it and gratitude for it. You also need to communicate with people of different ethnic communities, like, for example, with multi-ethnic carers here. And we've been having very interesting conversations, it seems to me, about Seoul, with carers here who come from South Asia. The mental care system depends to a large extent on the word, on the English word dignity. And that's a very good thing, because it's good if carers pay respect to people's dignity, regardless of their situation. But dignity, it's not a universal concept, and many people don't know what dignity is. Whereas, as I argue, a word like soul has its correspondent counterparts in all the languages. So you can relate to people regardless of what happened to them through words which are either entirely universal or to some extent universal and largely universal. So these are huge, applied problems here, which there is a huge applied potential of this approach to semantics, it seems to me.
Yeah. Okay, great. Excellent. Well, thank you very much for answering those questions.
Yes. Thank you.